First, I will mention the collider constraint on the dark matter and the standard model particle couplings through the Tevatron, LHC, and also mention about the net. And then I will then we will go to the astrophysics, like the how to constrain the asymmetric dark matter through stars, for example, the sun, the neutron stars. So so the last topic will be the constraint on dark matter self-interaction from the dark matter halo shapes. So I will focus on the nearby galaxy, elliptical galaxy, NGC 720. For the comparison, I will also mention the constraint from bullet class.
So what is special about this particular galaxy?
We understand it very well about this galaxy. Measure the shape, the density, velocity, dispersion. So we pick up an example from the elliptical galaxy. So that's a bit. Okay, so the evidence for the dark matter, I think the famous evidence is the rotation curves of the galaxies. So this is a galaxy and they rotate around the center. So you can measure the velocity around the radius. And, you know, what we observe is that it is a constant around the, if you go far from the center. But on the theory side, if we just take into account the luminous matter, and you would expect the velocity would drop from the Newton gravity. But there's a discrepancy. So this discrepancy can be resolved by dark matter. So the idea is that, you know, if you leave from the center, if there's some matter, it can provide additional gravitational force. And well, of course, that it's also possible that you can modify the gravity if the Newtonian gravity doesn't work at the galaxy scale. But it turns out that if you use modified gravity, you try to fit this data, it also works very well. But the point is that in the past 30 or 40 years, we accumulate more evidence, other additional evidence for the existence of dark matter. For example, if we understand, you know, if we look at the larger structure formation, the very, very large scale, and even the galaxy formation, the modern view of the galaxy formation is that the dark matter, you know, the dark matter form a halo first, then the baryon fall into the gravitational potential well provided by the dark matter. So then, you know, you form stars and so forth. And also the CNB observations, in some, you know, spots it's hot, some spots it's cold. This actually reflects the dark matter density, perturbation at the CNB epoch. And also gravitational lensing and other, you know, other evidence. So I wanted to emphasize that all the evidence for the dark matter is from the gravitational interactions. This slide shows you what we know about dark matter, what we don't know about dark matter. So we know dark matter has to be cold. So it's the idea is that when it decouples from the thermal baths, it has to be non-relativistic. So it could be a little bit warm, but not too warm. And it has to be stable, or at least have a very long lifetime. And it has to be non-baryonic. So if it's baryonic, if they can form atom, so they can excite it, and so this atom can be excited, and then going back to the ground state, it will lose energy. So it will, the dissipation. So if this is true, then you will not able to form a halo. You will form a disk. Okay. So it's non-baryonic, and it has to be dark, otherwise we should have seen. And we also know the density, about 20% of the total energy of our universe is dark matter. But so then we can locate the particle spectrum in standard model. We'll find, you know, there's no candidate in the standard model for dark matter. But we also don't know like very basic things about dark matter. We don't know the mass, we don't know the spin, no, we don't know the quantum number. So on the particle on the particle physics side to understand the dark matter, I think one well studied example is called a thermal wink. Wink means weakly interacting massive particles. So the idea is that in standard model, there's no dark matter candidate. So what you can do is that you can add some particle called X to the standard model. So assume that the X particle has some interaction with the standard model particles. So in the early universe, so two standard model particles can annihilate to produce X particle. So you can, you know, dark matter particle can populate in the early universe in the thermal mass. So there's also inverse process, two dark matter particles can annihilate to a standard model particle. So in the if the temperature is very high, these particles are in the thermal equilibrium. When temperature drops, these particles become non-relativistic. So its number density is slightly suppressed. So at some point, two dark matter particles are no longer able to find each other to annihilate. So we call it, the number density of the dark matter particle just, you know, frozen out. So it becomes a constant. If this scenario is true, that you can easily calculate the relic abundance. Okay, it's roughly inverse proportional to the annihilation cross-section, because that if the annihilation cross-section is big, the annihilation, you know, can keep the dark matter particle in the thermal equilibrium longer, so you will have this number density. But there's a coincidence, this annihilation cross-section actually is just a weak scale annihilation cross-section. So there's a remarkable coincidence, dark matter and a weak scale new physics could be related to each other. Another idea is that asymmetric dark matter. So here we assume that in the usual thermal dark matter, we assume the dark matter has zero chemical potential. Especially like in the supersymmetric models, dark matter is a neutralino, so it's a Majorana particle. So it cannot carry the chemical potential. But so dark matter could carry also chemical potential, which means that there's a conserved dark matter number. So this idea is motivated by the observation that the dark matter and the baryon ratio is quite close. So, but for baryon, it's very different. For baryon, you know, we have baryon, but you know, the anti-baryon number is really negligible. So there's baryon anti-baryon asymmetry. So it could be on the dark matter side, there's a baryon, the dark matter anti-dark matter asymmetry. It was a very old idea recently, you know, people are getting interested in it again. So the difference will be, in this case, dark matter has a non-zero chemical potential. So you can think that the usual thermal wink is the symmetric limit of this story. And also in this case, the dark matter should be Dirac fermion or complex scale because it carries charge. Another thing I wanted to emphasize there is that for the ADM, for the asymmetric dark matter, we still needed to have a large annihilation cross-section. The reason is that in the very early universe, when temperature is much bigger than the chemical potential, so you have the similar amount of X and X bar. There's slightly difference here due to the asymmetry. But now we only have X, so we have to deplete the symmetric component. So we still needed to have like larger annihilation cross-section. So typically, if you take the dark matter asymmetry, is similar to the baryon asymmetry, you typically need the large WIMP cross-section. So I wanted to mention that I take three here, but I take six here because dark matter is a Dirac particle now. You have to double degree of freedom. So the annihilation cross-section roughly double. You can, you know, XX bar can annihilate to Higgins effect particles. But on the other hand, this XX bar can annihilate to the standard model particles. So we would get collider constraint, as I will show you. So then for the symmetric dark matter, asymmetric dark matter, what's the difference? Well, for the usual WIMP, the people think that it's very predictive. The reason is that if this is the time direction, So dark matter annihilation produces standard model particle. It also gives rise to the indirect detection signal from the annihilation. But if the time is around this direction, two standard model particle can produce dark matter particle. This is a collider physics. You can say something about that. And if the time direction is around this, around here, then this is direct detection. So, you know, from the relic abundance, you can pretty much determine the parameter you need to get correct on this kind of, on these interactions. And on the other hand, for ADM, you still can have like collider constraint, direct detection, relic abundance, but now because X bar is negligible, so you wouldn't expect the annihilation close, the indirect detection signals from annihilation. But now the way you have to locate something else. The way to locate is that you look for accumulation, okay? Because the dark matter will not annihilate, it can accumulate somewhere. So you can look at it, the signal from the accumulation.
So I have a question for you about that point. Uh-huh. In many of those models, you consider a pretty light asymmetric dark matter, uh-huh. maybe a GPU or so. Uh-huh. We know we produce antiprotons and antielectrons in the processes, right? If it's energetic enough, we can definitely produce those things. Has anyone looked at constraints on that sort of thing?
Antiproton? I guess I didn't get what you said.
Well, we produce antiprotons and positrons in the sky, right?
Oh, you through annihilation or?
Well, whatever. I mean, in a pulsar wind, you have enough energy to produce those things. In supernova explosions, you might have enough energy to produce those things.
But why is it related to dark matter?
Well, in principle, you have enough energy to produce that.
Oh, to produce a dark matter particle.
To produce anti-dark matter.
To produce anti-dark matter particle.
Right.
I don't think that people look at this. Okay, so one thing I can say is that some people look at if there's a symmetric dark matter decay kind of thing, right? Okay. So for the symmetric dark matter particle, you know, you have, you know, dark matter, anti-dark matter particle, then it's annihilation or decay, then you produce equal number E plus E minus. But in this case, if you only have X, the X decay only produce E, for example, electron instead of a positron. So then you will change the spectrum of the, you know, cosmic rays. People look at that, but not what you said about it. Okay, so now we are going to talk about the collider constraint. So because we actually know nothing about how dark matter coupled to the standard model particle, right? So one way to address this issue is that you take the effective theory approach. So the idea is that you don't know what's the fundamental physics, but you always can write down the high dimensional operator. This is invariant on the Lorentz symmetry. So in this kind of approach, that there's only one parameter, we call it M star. So this is so-called a cutoff scale. So you can imagine that you have a UV completion model, some particle just mediate this kind of interactions. But if it's heavy enough, then we can integrate it out and you leave with this high dimensional operator. So there's only one prime M star. So the strategy will be we can constrain this kind of process and we wanted to say what's the implications on the, you know, direct detection and the relic density. Okay. So if you have this kind of operator and you in the collider you can, you know, QQ or QQ bar you can produce a dark matter particle pair. But if dark matter particles are like missing in a new signal, so you are not able to see it if you just produce this, if you just produce X bar. But you have to have something to trigger the signals. So what you can do is that you can attach a, you know, radiation, let's say it's good one. So in this case, it will be the missing in a new plus mono jet search. So it has a new contribution to the missing in a new plus mono jet search. I wanted to emphasize that the cutoff scale M star will determine everything. So Okay, so the way we do is that we simulate this the operators. Oh, okay, so we simulate the collider signals and its machine energy plus monojet, and we compare with the experimental result.
So what is the typical value for the cutoff you have?
Sorry?
What is the typical value for the cutoff?
Yeah, I'm going to show you next slide. So this contribution cannot be very big because the current observation of a monojet plus missing energy agrees with standard model prediction very well. So the way we, okay, so here is the way we present the result. So the horizontal axis is the dark matter mass. So this is the M star. So I will just, there are 14 operators, but I show you like four examples. So this is the line, so this is for operator D5, D6, D7, D8. And you can think of this as a vector current, this is actual vector current. So this is a bond actually from Savitron. Okay, so it says that the constraint from monojet plus missing ET search push the M star have to be higher than this line. Here there's drops because dark matter has mass. If the dark matter has mass, the production rate becomes smaller. So the bond becomes weak.
But isn't that a little bit too stringent? Because if you really go to M star of like 100 GeV and M chi of 100 GeV, then the center of mass energy is greater than the cutoff, and this effective operator is not on the bottom.
Yeah, so, excuse me, sorry. Actually, we shade out this regime. I didn't show you, sorry about that. So in some regime that the effective approach just don't work, yes. It's not very obvious. It's obvious in my laptop because we shaded this regime, the effective field theory approach doesn't work, yes, that's right.
But in your shading, is it just basically looking at making sure that two times the mass of chi is lower than the cutoff?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, there's also coupling involved, right? So you take a coupling to be order one, then. Yeah. So do not trust the result if go very big. But this part is true. You can trust the result.
Sorry. You're assuming order one coefficients for the operators?
Yes, that's right. Just we consider one operator at once. So what you can see is that this is a bound. But this is a LHC result. This is like a 14 keV LHC expected discovery kind of expectation. I will mention the current LHC bound on that. But when we did the paper, actually there's no LHC data on that yet. Okay. So what you can see is that for these two operators. So around this line, and you can get a collector radical abundance. So you can see that for these two operators, for operator 8 and operator 6, you are not able to get a collector radical abundance because the parameter space has been excluded by monojet search. The reason for that is that for these two operators, the annihilation, dark matter annihilation cross section is p-wave suppressed. So you needed a smaller cutoff scale to get correct relic abundance. But for these two, you are still able to get correct relic abundance. But if you extended this line, below 1 GeV also, you'll still have potential. So if you have dark matter below, like around the GeV or below, so you cannot use this high dimensional operator to get relic abundance, right?
What are the operators you crossed out?
Okay, sorry about that. The operator I crossed out is that you cannot get relic abundance. Something happened like this. So usually very few operators is allowed to get relic abundance if the dark matter mass is 10 or 60. And so it's very limited choice. For this kind of operator, you will understand that because it's coupled to gluons, so the production rate is very big, 8 to 10.
I think the situation is more complicated. So in the annihilation case, if you have a mediator like mice, just as twice of the dark matter mice,
yeah, yeah.
the kind of narrative.
So we didn't consider the resonance effect. If you consider, you are talking about resonance effect, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And if it is, if the media mass is smaller than the mass of dark matter.
That's, I'm not sure about this actually. So that's right. So in this case, so the mediator mass had to be heavier than dark matter mass, even heavier than the, you know, the transverse momentum, right? Because this is only valid for the collider environment, for the effective theory to be valid. So now, in general, that the mediator mass here had to be larger than about 100 g. Otherwise, you're going to produce it at the collider, so the effective approach is effective theory. Approaches tend to work. Okay. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. So the mass scale had to be high. So you, we also can compare the collider result with directed detection. Right? So this is spin independent scattering cross section. What we can see is that this plot is very busy, but what we can see is that for some operator like B11s, this B11 is that dark matter coupled to gluons, so you can see that, you know, Tevkel can do very good, you know, even for the low dark matter mass, but HC can do much better. And like for the T1 operator, the operator, this operator, so LHC actually can do very good job for you. Well, the reason why we can have this map is that, as I mentioned, that the collider bound will put up upper bound, the lower bound M star. So then M star will determine everything. Okay, so then people started this, what we can learn from the AHC at the 70 eV. So this is what they do. So this is for the operator D1 to D4. This is proportional to the mass here.
Okay, I don't understand. Did you just say that D1 is excluded?
Sorry.
Or are they just specific?
No, so okay, what they say is that, so this is a cutoff scale. So this is Tevkel bound. Tevkel tells you that they have above this. But the current LHC result actually already put a much the better bound with respect to the, you know, Tevkel result. Because, yeah.
Right, but if I'm gun hold about getting the right abundance, I should need to consider D1.
Yes, that's right. So that's right. So this is kind of just from, I think on this plot we didn't, you know, they didn't put the relative density constraint on that. They just look at, you know, LHC, what we can learn from, you know, 70 eV kind of LHC learning. So already you already got, you know, better results for M star compared to the temperature. So you also can do, you take the similar approach, the effective theory approach. You can reanalyze the lip data and understand how the dark matter can couple to the electron, basically. So that's what they do. It's a Fermi level group, but you have to look at now the mono photon. Well, mono photon is not mono jet because it's at the lab. So what you can see is that this, the cutoff scale had to be bigger than, you know, 300 to 500 GeV. Okay, again, you can analyze this with respect to the relative abundance. So what you can see is that if you have dark matter mass around 10 GeV also, it's really hard for dark matter to achieve the correct relative abundance if it's coupled to the electron or universally coupled to three leptons. So here's a more there's some conclusion is that the Tevatron lep sets strong constraint on dark matter and the standard model couplings. For light dark matter, probably you need a light mediator to achieve the relative abundance. And also from here you can see that the collider also can provide a very good constraint on the directed detection. It's, for some operators, actually, it's better. If you consider the spin-dependent operator, the scattering, that the Tevatron can do much better for some operators. All right, any questions? So if not, so we change the topic slightly. We try to look at the astrophysics constraint on the ADM. Well, typically there are no annihilation signals, so we look for the ADM accumulation. So ADM can accumulate at the center, at the center of the sun. So the idea is that if this is some stars, the dark matter particle will come and it will just captured by the they were captured by the stars, and then they lose energy, then they drift to the center.
Actually, that picture is not quite right, right? Like the first scattering most likely happen close to the center.
Most scattering what? Sorry.
The first scattering will happen close to the center, not in the surface. Because the density is much larger than the center.
You can tell you what circle.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
If you meant that this is the core, then I'm
okay, this is.
I don't think that's what you meant.
Okay, yeah, okay, yeah, good. So it's happened, should be, yeah, it's inside because it's the density, the nuclear density is higher to the density. That's good. So this the work did by a European group. What they see is that they try to locate the sun, the capture into the sun. What they found is that, so this is the radius of the sun and the normalized to the, you know, the sun radius. And so this is the temperature. So the effect is that the captured ADM particles will transport the heat and reduce the solar temperature. And on the other hand, the production rate of the neutrinos from the solar is very sensitive to the temperature. So what you can see is that if there's no dark matter, there's no wind, so the temperature, this is temperature profile, it goes like this. But if you increase the, if you have, you know, dark matter particle and increase the scattering cross section, you will reduce the temperature, okay? So then you can map this to the neutrino flux. So this also the radius, the solar radius. So this is a neutrino flux.
Okay, but I mean, our bounds to the ray detection are better.
Yes, good. Yes, so this is just to show you that there's actually, to achieve this effect, what's how large is the cross section you need. Okay, apparently for the spin independent scattering cross section, this has been excluded actually by country.
No, you meant spin dependent.
No, yeah, well, for spin dependent scattering, probably this is still roughly allowed on the boundary.
I don't think so, but anyways.
Okay. Yeah. Oh wow. Okay. So I didn't have.
You're saying you need at least that much to affect a change of 0.05 in temperature.
Yeah. Yeah. So that. So basically, this will show you that if a scattering cross section is that big, so you can have like observable effect on the solar neutrino flux. Okay.
And so can you explain a little more detail? The idea is that
So you capture the dark matter particle. This is ADM, so they will not annihilate. So always accumulate.
Right.
For the annihilation, if a dark matter has annihilation, the number will saturate, right? Once you reach the equilibrium. If not, so the number just increase, and so it to the center. But it has also near the in the it, for the dark matter at the center, you also have like orbit, some trajectory. So it will move along. When they move along, they will scatter the baryons. So we will bring the heat from the inner part to the slightly outside. Okay. So the heat transport. So it will reduce the temperature to the very, very, the very, very central part.
Really, these guys did that in detail?
Yeah, they did it in detail. They learned the numerical code on the solar model. Modeling.
Because it doesn't take much to, like, after like 10 scatters,
yes.
You are dipping inside the core.
Yeah, you are dipping inside of the core, but the trajectory is still kind of large enough can bring the temperature down. All right?
The constraint that you said comes from the neutrino flux?
Sorry?
The reason we know that has not happened is because of the neutrino flux?
Yeah, neutrino flux. Yeah.
And that's better than helium seismology? That gives you a better bound than helio seismology.
I think so. Yes. Yeah.
So helio seismology would be more sensitive to the outer.
always, it's very sensitive to the other part, but they can reconstruct the profile all the way down. And then the paper data, you get that part of the disk. But they've got so many modes to look at.
So how deep is that?
Well, first of all the way. So they have G modes and P modes, and they have a different kind of fall off. The P modes like to fall off as a building, as a G modes grow. The P modes are what they're saying, but they've got a lot of modes, so they have a lot of information about the profiles.
Yeah, actually, yeah, so there are you know, two papers that are arguing each other.
Oh,
there's precisely what you said, the effect you said. Some people claim that there's effect. Someone claim more careful calculation claim that there's no effect. Okay, there's an argument on that. Actually, I talked to one of the authors in CERN, so they that's what they say. So the reality is like the neutrino flux is probably more like of the more solid thing to think about this, to construct this kind of model. Okay, so. Yes, so as you mentioned that to have the visible effect, the scattering cross section had to be very large. It's nearly excluded by experiment. But so we can think about something else, right? We can think about the neutron stars. So why do we think about neutron stars? We can make a comparison between neutron star and the sun. So they have the similar mass, but the neutron star has a much higher density. Okay. So the high density will do many things for you. First of all, the escape velocity will be big, so you are able to capture more dark matter particles. And also density is high, so it will, for dark matter particle, it's easy for dark matter particle to lose the energy and thermalize with the neutron inside of the neutron star. And also the temperature is relatively low compared to the sun temperature because the neutron star is an older star. So the advantage to think about neutron star is that because of the high density, so you will have like high capture rate and a faster thermalization. And because our temperature is low for some bosonic dark matter particle, if you capture enough, it will form the boson SI condensate. Okay, so I will tell you what's happened after that.
Really?
So,
I mean,
yes.
Aren't you going to be too hot for that?
No, not yet. Not. So here's our expectation. Okay. I wanted to show you next a few slides that this captured asymmetric dark matter particle, if it's a scalar, can satisfy the conditions that this captured particle will form a mini black hole into the center of neutron stars. And if they do form a black hole, it will destroy neutron stars. But we observe very old neutron stars. Now, so this, we can use this to put a constraint on the capture rate, then the dark matter and the baryon scattering cross section. Okay? So this slide is also pretty busy, but I just wanted to go through the step with you. So the first thing you calculate the capture rate is that, so within the, let's say take the 10 to the 10 years for very old neutron stars. And take the slightly high local density, the slightly high dark matter density. So within the age of neutron star, we can roughly capture 10 to the 44 dark matter particles.
Per second?
No,
per year.
10 to the 10 years.
Oh, in 10 to 10 years.
The whole age of neutron star. All right? So then the step two is that once you capture one dark matter particle, as he said, it should happen around here, it will scatter with these neutrons. Because neutron density is very high, so it needs a very short time scale to thermalize with neutron. All right, it takes 0.05 years to thermalize with neutron.
Why the energy density can be that high?
This one?
Much higher than
much higher than the local density. The reason I put a high number is that make you excited. You will feel exciting about this number, but I will go to more realistic number when I put to the bomb. Okay, so this is not. But if you look at this,
why did you stop there? Why didn't you take a number?
Yeah, I will take like 10 to the 9 GeV percent. You will feel more exciting about.
Well, I mean, this number did appear in the literature as possible number in certain regions. I mean, I think it's highly unlikely.
Yeah, some people argue like in the globular clusters, they may think have a high density. But we don't take this seriously. So when we put a real bond, we take, you know, more realistic number on that. Okay, so this is second step, the thermal line. So it looks like you just put a dark matter into a refrigerator, cool it down. Because the density, neutral density is very high, so the cooling process is very efficient. The third, well, okay, so after the thermolyte, so the, we can look at the status, right? So if this is a neutron star, and some dark matter particle will stay in the thermal state, okay? So you can calculate the, what's the distribution, the radius, okay, if they are staying in the thermal state. It's about, a, you know, 10 centimeter, 24 centimeter. But remember that the neutron star, the radius of a neutron star is 10 kilometers. We can imagine that this captured dark matter particle is really staying very, very small radius. So the density could be very high. And also, if the neutron.
I mean, that's not something you need to speculate about, right? So physical mechanics tells you what the density is. It goes like the density goes like the gravitational potential.
Yeah.
So you know that number.
Yeah, so that you
so
calculate
this. Number
yeah, that's the number you calculate. But if the neutron star can keep, you know, capturing the dark matter particle, at some point, if the phase space in the thermal state has been occupied, some of the newly captured dark matter particle will go to the ground state. This is true for the scalar dark matter. So it can form boson and condensate. So once they form boson and condensate, then the radius is even much smaller. It's about 10 to the minus 5 centimeters. You know, you squeeze a lot of dark matter particles, it's a very small radius. Okay, so the third step is that if in this area, the dark matter density is much higher, begins to higher than, the, becomes higher than the baryon density. So the dark matter system will become self-gravitating. Because it gets the gravitational interaction from baryon and also dark matter particle itself. But the dark matter particles, the gravitational interaction from the dark matter particle themselves is higher than the gravitational interaction from the baryon. So they start to self-gravitate. So you can get a condition for this. So if there's no BEC state, then you need a you need about 10 to the 44 dark matter particles in the thermal state such that the system becomes self-gravitating. But if you form BEC state, you only need about 10 to the 23 dark matter particles. So the system here will become self-gravitating. That's because the radius is small, so the density is very high. But remember that within the age of a neutron star, you can cap about 10 to the 44. Number of dark matter particles.
Well,
so
it's divided by thousands.
Sorry, divided by a solid, yes. Then you also change the dark matter mass. You know. Okay, then you also win.
Well,
you
no,
can
no,
also.
No. That's, that you cannot do, right? Then you have
you can increase the mass slightly, right? Because this is a 5 over 3, so this is a linear proportion, proportionality.
Do you want to increase or increase? Here
you're gonna increase the mass so the total number becomes smaller, self-gravitating. That's because if the dark matter mass is higher, so the density, the energy density is higher, right? So, okay. But we have to check another condition, so-called the Chandrasekhar limit. So the idea is that for a kind of system with a lot of particles, for fermions, you know, there's gravity, between each other, between these particles, there's also Fermi pressures. So you can derive a condition that only when the total number of the particles larger than this number, this term will dominate, will overcome the Fermi pressure, such that the system can collapse, okay, to a black hole. But for bosons, there's no Fermi pressure. So only thing you wanted to overcome for the collapsion is that you have to overcome the zero point energy, basically. So this from the quantum mechanics. So this tells you that two So a dark matter system that captured by the neutron star, if they wanted to go through the gravitational collapse, the total number you need is about 1.5 times 10 to the minus 34. But remember again that within the neutron star, within the age of neutron star, you can capture about 10 to the 44 number of dark matter particles. So it's kind of easy to simplify this condition. All right, so, okay. So briefly, once the dark matter particle captured by neutron stars larger than the density number for the self-gravitation is larger than the Chandrasekhar limit, you will form a black hole into the neutron star center. Okay. That's a little tiny mini black hole into the neutron star center. So what will this black hole do for you? The first of all, they will it will attract the baryon, nearby baryons. The baryon will go into it. But there's also Hawking radiations. So black hole can radiate the massless particles, the Hawking radiations. So what you can see is that if the initial black hole mass is large, so this term will dominate the story. The black hole mass just increasing, will be increasing, and it will destroy the neutrons. But if this term dominates, it will just evaporate. So what if this term dominates, what will the neutron star do is that it will just recycle all the dark matter particles to radiation. So there's, because the energy pretty small, so there's no, so far I think there's no observable effect for this, if this term dominates. So, okay, so we can derive a critical black hole mass. So this is
It will heat up
a neutron star, but the total energy release actually it's not so big. So, you know, compared to the whole neutron star, the effect is really negligible. Okay, so we can derive a critical black hole mass. This is given by this 1.2 times 10 to the 37 GeV.
No, but actually, I'm not sure if I did that. I mean, people talk about capture of dark matter in neutron stars and heating it up from annihilation.
Yeah.
Right?
Good.
If you have enough energy to heat up the neutron star from that, why should you not have it here?
Well, okay. So I think for the annihilating dark matter people are talking about, but to the effect, it's we're not able to observe it.
Well, it's borderline, but that's more of an observational issue. I mean,
yeah.
You're saying we order magnitude away, which I don't quite.
What?
Because this is basically effective. It's the most effective annihilation you can get. Right? You convert all your dark matter into
radiation.
Into radiation, that the black hole flows back into the neutron star.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but yeah, okay. So I think we roughly estimated the energy release from the Hawking radiation.
Yeah.
But remember that you have to compare with the kind of cooling process or things like that. But you can imagine that the total number of dark matter particles you can capture is 10 to the 44. But a neutron has, for a neutron, typical neutron star, the number of neutrons is about 10 to the 50, 10 to the 54. So the dark matter, the mass is really, really small amount. But again, yes, I agree with you that you have to compare with the heat release or things like
right.
that. So we have to look at that careful, but yeah, so.
Yeah, the
Hawking
radiation is different from the annihilation. They
radiate
all species.
Right, but they will hit up the neutron star. Right? Almost all everything you emit will interact strongly with the
neutron
star. Oh, yeah, sure.
Never tell to baryons.
No, but by and large, unless you emit into neutrinos, that stuff you emit will hit up the neutron star.
Yeah, also neutrinos, probably photons. For photons.
Photons, you'll hit up the neutron star. Pretty much anything except the neutrinos will hit up the neutron star.
Well, dark matter, if it's very massive, then the radiation rate is not so important.
But it's possible that the energy is less massive. It's not like if you radiate into photons,
No, but it's the same. All I'm saying is that I'm making a comparison with other studies. I'm just comparing other studies that have looked at dark matter annihilation and stuff. and their findings that it will hit up a different star. This is no different than just an object in a different star.
That's right. But so the question is, what's the effect? Yeah, how big is the effect? So, okay. So, but we know that we do observe very old neutron stars, and so which means this process doesn't happen. We can try to exclude some parameter space, right? So we pick up a neutron star here, nearby neutron star, and we take real dark, realistic dark matter density, and so what we can see is that in this region, because of the BEC formation, so this has been excluded. About 13 GeV dark matter mass. So this excluded to 10 to the minus 47 for the dark matter and the barrier, the neutron scattering cross section. And this region has been excluded without a BEC formation because for heavier dark matter mass, it becomes self-gravitating much faster. And so this shaded region, we cannot apply the bond because of the minimum black hole mass is less than the critical mass I derived from the Hawking radiation. Okay, so in this region, the mini black hole just evaporate; it will not accumulate the barriers. Okay, this region we cannot apply the bond because dark matter cannot thermalize with neutron within the age of neutron star. Because for heavier dark matter mass, it carries much more kind of kinetic energy. All right, so we pick up another neutron star. I also use realistic number for density. So here, what you can see that we don't have this, this regime here. The reason is that a neutron star has a high roughness, about one order magnitude higher the temperature. So we cannot form the BEC state. We only excluded this region.
What knob do I turn to decide whether I have a BEC or not?
Here.
Yeah.
Okay, I think it's to determine if you form BEC or not is that it's mainly determined by the mass, actually. Because if its mass is small, so if the mass is small, so the number density will be high, so you can capture more dark matter.
Right. So in your picture, the two colors are not significant. You're saying if I have low mass, I will have a BEC, and that will be the exclusion zone.
Yes.
I don't have an option of not having an exclusion zone.
So you mean the pointer here?
Yeah, the red your slide, I thought that having green versus yellow meant that for a given mass and a given cross section, I could have a choice as to whether or not I had a BEC.
Oh, you mean why I use a different color?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just that BEC formation, no BEC formation. That's all they do. This has a different. Yeah. There's a different physical reason to exclude this parameter space. That's the reason why. But I do have different, the shaded regime here. But this involves slightly more complicated physics involved. So I will not talk about this here. So okay. So good. So now now we are considering dark matter self interactions. The self-interacting dark matter was first proposed by Spergel and Sternhardt trying to resolve the cosmological issues about cold dark matter. So basically, in the n-body simulation, if you just take the cold dark matter, you will see Caspi kind of density. Basically, it's the dark matter halo. It's the center. The density profile is blows up, and also you will see like more small structure like dwarf galaxies. But from the observation, we know that this doesn't happen. So they propose if dark matter have self-interactions, they will resolve this issue. And so the scattering type they consider is contact interaction. Roughly speaking, if you the dark matter self-interaction is mediated by some pretty heavy massive particles, so you can integrate it out, and you will get contact interactions. So recently, self-interacting dark matter kind of get people are getting interested in again for different reasons. So what we consider is that we just imagine that if the dark matter can stabilize by unbroken Hilbert sector U1, just like the electron is stable, but it's one way to understand this is it's stabilized by unbroken U1 electromagnetism. So in that case, dark matter particle can talk to the massless, hidden sector massless photon. So the dark matter is self-interacting. More recently, there's also the dissociative case that between these two. So in the class of Sommerfeld enhancement dark matter model, dark matter mass is like 1 TeV or 10 TeV, but you have light mediator, so it's below 1 GeV or 100 MeV or so. So this is also massive mediator, but between these two. This case is extremely long-range interaction. This is extremely short-range interaction. So this is between. So it also can also mediate the dark matter self interactions. So of course, the classical bound on the dark matter self-interaction cross-section is from the Bucquet class. So the idea is that, so the observation is that, so this is the main cluster, this is the subcluster, is smaller. So they just, you know, they collide, they pass each other. And the red region is the baryons, so they stop and they kind of collide each other. But the blue region, like dark matter, so they just pass each other. After the collision, it turns out the subcluster also survived. Okay, it's also survived. So you can put a constraint on that. The reason is that, okay, so this is the kinematics. So if there's one dark matter particle in the subcluster, this additional, the another dark matter will another dark matter particle comes. This is in the main cluster. So it will scatter with the particle here. After the scattering, so the two dark matter particles, the one has a velocity V1, another one has a velocity V2. So if V1 and V2 are much larger than escape velocity of the subcluster, so the subcluster will have net particle loss, okay? So if this happens very often, if all scattering cross-section is big, the subcluster will just disappear. It cannot survive after the collision. So you can put a bound on this scattering process. So the bound you derive is, you know, about the dark matter self-scattering cross-section divided by the mass is 1 cm/g. So you can convert it to the in the unit that we're more familiar. And so here I wanted to mention that in the initial proposal for self-interacting dark matter by Spergel and Stanhard is that to resolve this cosmological problem, they prefer the regime for the scattering cross-section per unit mass is 1 to 100 cm/g. Then they do simulation. The preferred region is 0.5 to 5 centimeters square per gram. And the Bucquet cluster actually put a bound on the 1 cm/g. So this bound actually already excluded the large parameter space here, preferred by the cosmological problem.
It's been known.
Sorry?
People know what V0 is?
V0, yes.
V0. What is it?
Roughly, it's about 10,000, I think.
Centimeters.
Yeah. No, 10,000 kilometers. A thousand kilometers.
So it's like a typical.
Yeah. A thousand. It's the variety is pretty large, actually. So. Okay. So we try to constrain the dark matter self-interaction from different angle. But if the dark matter self-interactions are strong enough, actually it can create all the one velocity changes. And so they can erase the an isotropy of the dark matter velocity dispersion and create a spherical halos. So what's happening is that, you know, if the dark matter part, if there's no scattering cross, there's no self-interactions, dark matter particle will keep an orbit, you know, elliptical orbit. So if there's a scattering, so the velocity just get randomized. So they tend to form the spherical halos.
Well, how do you get rid of the angular momentum?
What do you mean?
So I mean, if it has some electricity and then you rotate this way, you can get rid of the angular momentum.
Yeah, but the. Well, you still keep the angular momentum, right? But
when, well. But it can, the magnetic energy has to be positive momentum.
Yeah, no. If one particle come, another particle come. So the total kinetic energy will not change, of course. But each of them change the direction, right?
So they should still keep a spherical hill?
No. Oh, no, spherical hill, yes. Yeah. Not elliptical hill.
Yes.
Yes, that's right.
So why have a constraint on staff?
Because we observe elliptical hill.
Yeah, I mean, you have only elastic scattering.
Yes.
So you don't have dissipation?
Yes.
So
it will change.
I think his statement would be that if you start with elliptical and you have interactions, then you end up in spherical and you don't. You still see elliptical.
Oh,
yes. That's right.
Sorry.
That's right. Okay. So actually, we observe elliptical galaxies and the clusters. And so what we do is that we take a nearby well studied galaxy, NGC 720. It's elliptical. People have been, you know, studying this galaxy for like 30 or 40 years. We pick up the parameter. So here the velocity, the density is pretty high. It's a 4 GeV per centimeter cubic. So this is a typical velocity dispersion for dark matter particles.
When you say that you see there's a bunch of galaxies, not meant that they see the visible galaxies, but do they really know the dark matter?
Well, okay, it's a good point. So you, of course, cannot really measure the dark matter distribution itself. So what they do is that they measure the X-ray, the baryon emission from the X-rays. So then they're able to know what's the distribution of this baryon, this hot gas.
This is
okay.
This is in the middle of the cluster.
No, this is in the galaxy, this particular NGC 720 the galaxy. So they measure the distribution of this hot gas.
Why is there hot gas?
Why
is there hot gas? I thought the hot gas was found in clusters of galaxies. And I know that it's not true, look at the galaxies in the middle of that cluster. It's all by itself. Why does it have hot gas?
Well, I guess they look at the, okay, what they really look at the X-ray, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is coming from the hot gas. Okay. So then what they do is that they get hot gas, then they look at that distribution. Then they simulate the what kind of, you know, the dark matter gravitational potential will provide this kind of gravitational potential well for this gas. And then you understand that from the distribution, you understand that was the shape of the type of the gravitational well. Then they determine what kind of the density profile of the dark matter can provide this kind of gravitational potential well. Okay, so this indirect, yes, because we cannot observe the shape.
But the conclusion is that the density profile is elliptical.
Yes, it's
for dark matter.
For dark matter, yes.
Well, what they know is that it's sitting in an elliptical well. Assumption is that dark matter is not
ready
that well.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Right. But if you think of it, I'm just thinking that if it's on a cluster size, I think a lot of these filaments are running together and these clusters are often where these filaments are intersecting. And so you can imagine there's lots of ways in which the filaments themselves are if the dark matter itself is not. If you're at the intersection of a bunch of these filaments, you're not expecting to be inside the spherical distribution of dark matter, right? So the dark matter distribution itself isn't starting out spherical.
Yeah, I think you also can get a bond from the elliptical cluster, right? The people did this work. I think the bond is because for the cluster, the dark matter density is kind of it's smaller than this. So the bond you derive there actually is kind of one order magnitude smaller than the bond I'm going to talk about. Anyway, so we define a quantity. This is scattering rate to create the order one velocity change. Of course, there's an order one factor we don't know. But we compare this result, this rate, with the simulation result. So we try to determine what kind of order one factor is. Okay, before we're doing like n-body simulation on that. So we demanded that. The you know, the scattering rate had to be small enough such that within the age of galaxy, you cannot create the order one velocity change. So if we take these two premises and you put into it, yeah, we can derive a bond on the dark matter scattering cross-section, self-scattering cross-section per unit mass. So this is about 44 times 10 to the minus 27 centimeters per GeV. So from this limit, of course, I just consider the contact interaction. If you are talking about the long-range interaction, actually this bond could be much stronger. The reason is that in the long-range interaction, just imagine it's a Coulomb interaction, it's inverse proportional to the velocity to some power. So for bullet cluster, it has a large velocity, but for the halos, the velocity dispersion is small. For the long-range interactions, the bond from the galaxy, the elliptical galaxy, is much strong, much stronger than the result from the bullet cluster. Okay, so even for the contact interaction, you ignore the velocity effect. So this result is about two orders magnitude stronger than the bond from the bullet cluster. So I think this is the strongest bond we have for the dark matter self-interaction cross-section. Okay, so I finished my talk. This is a summary. And so I think I convinced you that, I try to convince you that the colliders actually can provide a very interesting constraint on the dark matter and a standard model particle the interactions. So we take an effective field theory approach. So it's kind of, we try to do it as model independent as possible. So we can also use the stars to constrain the asymmetric dark matter through the dark matter accumulation. Also, the ellipticity of the dark matter halos put a strong constraint on the dark matter self-interaction cross-section. So, okay, thank you for your attention.
Can you show your previous slide? I'm just going to try to set a feeling for that number. So if I had a 100 GeV particle and they're talking with something which is like a tenth of a bar or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a really small cross-section.
It's not really a small cross-section.
You can have strong interaction.
Yes. If you have like the lambda QCD, like, you know, 10 MeV or so, very okay. Yes. So this is just on the strong interaction region. It's very okay. So.
Could be a happy neutron.
Yes,
it's just barrier. Okay. Yeah, but this limit is do stronger than the, you know, the Bluetooth class.
Well,
with
Vesper, the
Bluetooth
class. Probably Vesper, the sticker enough, so maybe we should thank him again.
Thank you, guys.